This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 154, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. This week, I'm talking to Richard Dolan about his book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, the definitive guide to the UFO mystery. For over 20 years, Richard Dolan has been among the world's leading UFO researchers, historians, and publishers, and he is the author of several groundbreaking books in the UFO field. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 150 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. So we're going to be talking about your book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind.
Sure.
And do you see a big difference amongst what's happening with UFOs between the 20th century and the 21st? Or do you think it's just the same old, same old?
That's a great question. I don't know if anyone's ever asked that. I think this phenomenon started in a major way in the 1940s. I think I'm becoming a minority opinion on this. A lot of people will reflexively say, you know, they've been here forever. It's always been this way. There may be truth to that, but if they were here, and I think actually there has been a longstanding monitoring, I don't believe that whoever the they happen to be, by the way, are they gray aliens? Are they blonde Nordics? Who knows? But whoever they have been, when I look at the history of the sightings in ancient times, there are some good ones, but there are very few. And when you study a lot of them, they kind of fall apart. I think this has to be said. I believe we need to take a hard look at the whole idea of ancient aliens. Not to debunk it, but I think it's essential to if we really want to understand what this phenomenon is, we need to ask hard questions about certain things, such as how long have they actually been here for real? What is the nature of their behavior? Has there been a change in their behavior throughout the centuries in the ancient times and modern times? So your question is a very pertinent one for that reason. What I would just say is, in my estimation of reviewing ancient UFO or UAP sightings, something really changes when we humans get to what we would call the modern era. First, in the 18th, 19th century, you see a definite jump in good, well-observed sightings. And then another major jump in the Second World War. And then from that part of the 20th century until our own time, what I would say is it looks to me that we've seen a constant, ever-increasing amount of activity. But I don't know that I would say it's qualitatively different than the earlier parts of the 20th century. I'm just finishing a very long study right now on a different book project, which hasn't been published, but it's a three-volume history of USOs, so water-based UFO or UAP phenomenon. And then one thing that I've noticed in that, because I've done a statistical analysis there, it's a different book, but I started noticing a much higher percentage of nighttime encounters after the late 1960s. And I've wondered what this might entail. Is it that these operators are becoming more covert because of our better technology? Possibly. I don't really know the full answer. I do think that there's an adaptation that these other beings are probably, and I do think that there are other beings involved here, that they're adapting to us. So we're going through a technological revolution in many ways. They, whoever they are, they're here. They're observing us. They're looking at these smart little, pesky little, sometimes very aggressive humans, and they are probably having to make their own adjustments to our ever-changing capabilities.
One of the things that I think is weird about them is that they have lights all over them with these nighttime sightings. I would imagine those craft could easily travel around without lights on. It's like they want to be seen. They're showing themselves to us.
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they are ultra dark. And if you there's many sightings where I enjoy reading raw reports that on the MUFON database or the National UFO Reporting Center. You can just go read those. Often you'll come across a sighting. Someone will say, I couldn't sleep. I went out to look at the sky, smoke a cigarette, do whatever. I looked up, it's 2:30 in the morning, and there is this black triangle or saucer over my neighbor's house at 200 feet altitude, something like that, and which could have very easily been missed. So some of them are ultra covert and stealthy, and you have to wonder, what is that all about? But what you're saying is also true. There are a number of these evening sightings where you just see this intense light. There's all these different theories as to why that is. Are they trying to? Can they not help it? Is it a plasma effect from part of however they engage in propulsion? I don't really know. There are theories to that effect that, whereas they might be able to do electronic cloaking in different ways, maybe visual cloaking is not always as possible as we might think. Our attitude is, well, they're aliens. They can do anything. They're omnipotent. They know all. Maybe they have their limitations as well. And, I don't have the answer to some of these questions. So I'm guessing as much as you or the listeners sometimes.
I wonder if perhaps people see them because whoever's controlling these craft, they want you to see them. It's also maybe something to do with consciousness. I saw a craft, and I was driving down the motorway, and I dropped my speed to like 5 miles an hour, 1 o'clock in the morning. There were no other vehicles, and there was a craft at the side that was 25 feet off the ground, maybe 200 feet from me, shaped like a rugby ball. Across the whole bottom half, there's many, many pin spot red lights, and a very powerful beam of light coming from the other end of it. And it's completely silent, and it's just sat there as I drove past at 5 miles an hour, looking up at it from my windscreen.
Whoa.
No other cars around. And I went home, checked if there was any missing time. But I do wonder if perhaps they didn't need to light themselves up like that. Maybe they were there for me.
Sometimes, yes. Totally agree. So I mentioned this a few times. It's a fascinating case to me. I was in the Canadian National Archives years ago. And for a while there, if you were a Canadian citizen, you saw what you thought was a UFO, you could write to the government. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police would take your report and they would forward it. And the archives are available. So I read one written in the early 1980s by an elderly man who said, I was 25 years old in 1936. He had the coolest job around, in my opinion. He was doing aerial photography and mapping for the Canadian government in their most remote northern regions. So he had a pontoon aircraft that could land on water because there's an infinite amount of water up there. And he said, and he mentioned where he was. It was a lake called Aylmer Lake. Aylmer. If you look for it on Google Earth, you will gasp as I did. It's very remote. He said it was perfect spring afternoon. I was doing a pre-flight check with my aircraft, and I just happened to look up into a perfectly blue sky. There's nothing around this man for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers, miles. He looked up, and there was this elongated gunmetal gray object, no reflection. It was shaped, as we would say, a tic-tac today. Like the Tic Tac UFO, except this wasn't white, it was gray. No markings, nothing. It was in a north-south orientation, and he couldn't, the man was very articulate, and you could tell, very well-educated man, and he said, I couldn't really gauge the distance because there was nothing to gauge it against, but it had a clear view of it. And he watched it rotate instantly from north-south to east-west, and it instantly accelerated. He said it was at the horizon in moments. Now, there was nothing else there except him. And I've often thought about this. It's like 1936, a long time ago. And he writes this in years later. No one knew who this man was. He never sought publicity. He was just had this amazing experience. I had a UFO sighting many years ago with my son when he was 3 years old, a long, long time ago, 1999. I was in the home stretch of writing my first book. And like that Canadian man, it was May of 1999. It was, and like him, it was a perfectly blue sky in the city of Rochester, New York, where I lived for many years. And I was holding my son's hand. I looked straight up and I saw the brightest object I've ever seen in the sky in daytime, other than the sun. And I thought, this is the most reflective aircraft I've ever seen. It was amazing, but I couldn't really see any shape to it. And I was very much engaged in the UFO subject at that time. I was finishing my first book and I just stared at this object. And then this odd thought came into my mind, which was, if you look away, you'll never see it again, which was not logical because there was nowhere for this thing to hide. But that was the thought. Meanwhile, my poor son was wondering why his father had turned into a statue on the sidewalk, and he's trying to get my attention. And I thought, okay, I have to look at my boy, but I don't want to take my eyes off of his. So I actually pointed to hold its place in the sky. I turned to my son for 1 second. I said, I'm watching something. Hang on. And I look back, and of course, I think it was gone. Totally gone. I spent the next 5 minutes scanning the skies. And again, I'm thinking, is there some kind of mental connection here, as you were talking about, some kind of consciousness connection? And I think there is. I think that they, again, whoever they are, they have abilities to perceive in more powerful ways in certain areas than we probably do. And I don't really know what their motivations are. I don't really know what they're trying to do. But did that thing want to be seen? I'm guessing it did. But it seems almost egotistical, you know, to sit down and think, oh, yeah, they were doing that for me. Like, who am I? Why would you do this for me? Why am I any different than my neighbor or some other person? And so I've always felt a little odd about going down that road of thinking, oh, yeah, they're giving me a show. Or when people will often do the CE5 evenings, you know, where they're trying to meditate and vector in, as they would say, craft. I'm like, are they really going to take time out? They've got things to do, but they're going to do this for you. Okay, great. But sometimes it does feel like that.
It's like they wanted you to write these books. I wonder about that guy on that lake. What else was happening in his life and what happened after that in his life? Maybe that they just quickly showed themselves as a message to you, kind of like, you're on the right path, keep going with that book. And that ultimately your path, what they wanted you to go down, was to be this communicator and this guy that writes books and goes on podcasts and TV. And that is what they wanted for you. So they were just giving you a baby step along that path. Or maybe when you say a kick up the pants to say, yeah, pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what happened to me when I'm doing these podcasts.
Your sighting was quite amazing. What you described, that's one of the really extraordinary ones that when I'm searching for good encounters, like that's the kind that I'm looking for. What happened to me, it was a distant object in the sky. I mean, I was able to see it clearly, but I've always wanted to have something more visceral, something more up close, and it just hasn't happened. I don't know what their motivations in doing that are, except if they're operating on another level, they might be looking around for those humans who are maybe a little more interesting to them for one reason or another.
Or maybe they want their own kind of disclosure. That's why they prompted you to do what you do with your books. And lots of other people, maybe like me, and that they've got their own disclosure and their timeline is hundreds of years. We look at our timelines within our lifetimes, don't we?
There was no logic for me in my life to get into the UFO subject. There was no inherent reason that I would have done this. I had my own career path laid out. I wanted to teach history at a university. I was working on that goal and nothing to do with flying saucers at all. But I became obsessed with it, purely intellectually. I became obsessed with it. And I became aware that there were allegations of cover-ups and things like this. And I was studying the early Cold War, U.S. foreign relations, circa 1950, that type of thing. And so when I stumbled into UFOs and I became aware of all the claims of cover-up, same period of time, essentially, that I was studying academically. And my thought was, I don't like having this big question mark hanging over an area where I'm trying to become an expert. Was this a thing or was this not a thing? Because we've all heard of the claims of a UFO cover-up. And I just, for some reason, I didn't like not having that resolved. And so I thought I would take a little bit of time out of my life and find out, what is the argument that these believers have? Like, how compelling is the argument after all? And that was the rabbit hole I jumped into back in 1993, 94. That's what got me started 30 plus years ago now.
And do you feel there's too much conspiracy theory stuff that goes on around all this? It's almost like it's embarrassing in a way. You're trying to investigate UFOs and people think you're a conspiracy nut. Maybe you also think the world is flat and the moon landings didn't happen.
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned this. I got into the UFO field through the angle of conspiracy. It's what I think is true. I think that there are conspiracies. I think conspiracies are a normal part of most organizational behavior. I mean, everyone's competitive. Everyone's trying to get an edge over the other, whether it's a corporation or a nation. Of course, they conspire. We go through this pretend game in our society as if everything is based on rules and everyone follows the rules. And that's never been the case. Not in all of our history, it's ever been the case. So people lie, they cheat, they steal. It's what human beings do. To pretend, in my view, that that doesn't happen within the world of intelligence and government. I mean, my goodness. Now, having said that, I'll just continue. So when I finished my first book, which was many years ago now, it was volume one of UFOs in the National Security State. In 2000, that was considered a very conspiratorial book at the time. I look back on it now and I think it's pretty lukewarm. To be honest with you, one could go way farther than I did back then. But at the time, I will say there were UFO researchers who really took issue with my positions. But there is a problem with thinking that every single thing is a conspiracy. I certainly agree with that. We've gotten to a point where in our society, enough people have become aware that their establishment, let us say, lies with impunity on a regular basis about many, many things. And it is not to be trusted. Of course, it can't be trusted. The problem is people will then automatically assume that every single thing that they hear coming out of any established source is automatically going to be a lie or untruth. And that's a problem too. The thing is, we always want to be empirical. We always want to be analytical. We want to be critically minded. But being critically minded, not only does it not mean you just accept everything that is handed to you from established authoritative sources, as we often hear now, but it also means you don't just knee-jerk oppose it and say it's a lie. Like, you have to study it, analyze it, and it's hard work, and it's imperfect work. But no, there's a lot of conspiracies I do believe in. Are you kidding? I'll go down a lot of conspiracy rabbit holes with you, no problem.
Is it David Grush? And the two pilots, and they were talking at Congress.
Yeah, a year and a half ago.
They all seem like really qualified individuals, people who would know these things. But then didn't the Pentagon come out later and say, we have no evidence of any truth to what he's saying?
Correct. Yeah, well, so one is in a position of asking, what should I believe, right? That's what a lot of people wonder. I've looked at the long, long history of Pentagon statements on UFOs. I mean, they don't have a history of being truthful. There's no question. Forget UFOs. Look at any other number of subjects that are out there. The U.S. Pentagon does not have a good track record of being truthful about many things. The United States government doesn't. The United States government, we know this for a fact, engaged in MKUltra mind control experiments, and not just MKUltra. The Pentagon engaged in biological weapons testing against United States citizens during the 1950s and 60s and 70s, probably beyond, including people who died from those experiments. Hell, I was possibly in one of them myself. They did a biological weapons testing in the New York City subway system in 1966. I lived in New York City. I was 4 years old in 1966. Was I part of it? I have no idea. But they do all kinds of shenanigans. They always have. The United States engages in color revolutions around the world. This is a no longer arguable. All kinds of dark deeds that they will do to control the world, however you want to put it, they do. And they lie about it. They constantly lie about it. So that's just beyond UFOs. So when you look at the UFO subject, and I cover this fairly much in this book, if you go back to the 1940s, where the phenomenon really exploded in the modern world, you look at something like Roswell. Right? So let's say the Roswell event. Something did happen at Roswell. Everyone now knows something came down in the deserts of New Mexico, 75 miles north of Roswell, middle of nowhere. If, as I do think it was, something truly exotic and not just a balloon of some sort, put yourself in the position of your President Harry Truman of the United States. Your top generals and scientists say to you, "Sir, we've recovered something fairly exotic. It doesn't seem to be made from our civilization. And oh, yes, there's a couple of bodies. They don't look quite human." Let's just pretend that happened. Now you're in a position, you have to ask yourself, what do I do about this information? Do I tell the world? You might want to. And your advisors would very wisely say, maybe that's a dangerous idea. I say wisely from their point of view. They're trying to maintain control over the structure of power that they have. That's not a good idea, sir. If you tell the world you have this, now there's technology. What about the Russians? We have a monopoly of atomic technology. They're trying to get that. Do we want to give them something as exotic as alien technology? I think the answer is pretty obvious. They would not. And so you start this culture of secrecy, and it might be innocent. You might think, well, we'll just study this for a little while. Let's get a handle on it, and then we can make an announcement to the world. Fine. But of course, that never happens. The technology is too valuable. It's far too valuable. You're holding the future in your hands. There's money there. You retire from government service. You take a nice position with an aerospace or technology company, and you're on the ground floor of a great investment opportunity. Who knows? There's all kinds of possibilities here. And suddenly the years go by and the secrecy becomes more entrenched. It's outside the realm of Congress, which is supposed to have oversight, and it doesn't. You create what we call black budget culture, which is spending that is hidden from elected representatives, which is not supposed to be the case. But of course it is. You have a culture of what I call legal illegality, and it permeates the system. This happened to Britain. It happened to Rome. That is, when you start in one thing and then you become an empire, and becoming an empire changes you. It changes everything about you. And this has happened to America now. And you create essentially a new form of government without officially stating that it's a new form of government. And this is ruled by secrecy, as my old friend Jim Mars put it once. So the culture becomes entrenched, and then you have a number of other series of problems. Like, well, how do we maintain this secrecy? Now this is getting to be pretty intense. Now we have to have our people in academia. Okay, check, we've done that. We have to have our people managing the political situation. Check, we'll do that through bribes and blackmail and threats and rewards and all of that. Media, no problem. That's maybe the easiest of all. So you have a system in place by which you manage cultural discourse. Yes. And but now the problem that we're in the 21st century is we have an internet, and we have an explosion of non-regime spokespeople who are independently looking into things. And that is a problem. Years ago, I was, in fact, I think I predicted it in this book here. The first edition of his book was over a decade ago, and I then added on a substantial amount recently. But I was saying then, you know, the end of UFO secrecy is a bit of a paradox. It's impossible, but it's inevitable. A bit of both. It's impossible in the sense that to find motivation from those people who actually have control over this information, I can't ever see them being motivated to revealing what they know. But they're not the only part of the equation. So we're in a world that is going through a revolution on many levels, technologically for sure. And so that keeps things in flux, and leaks can happen, mistakes can happen, opportunities can arise in which information can break out and cause problems. And that's, I think, what we are seeing today. I think we're living in that type of era. That doesn't mean disclosure is immediately inevitable, but we can see that the public conversation has been changing over the past 6-7 years now. And where it will go is really a good question. And I don't know how to predict that. But in terms of, you mentioned David Grush talking about acquisition of technology, non-human biologics, as he put it at one point. Those statements are 100% exactly in line with over 50 years of research that private independent researchers have done in the realm of what we can call crash retrievals and everything related. Since really the 1970s, there has been some very compelling research done, and much of which I did delineate in UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, by researchers who would collect their own testimony from Air Force, Navy, other military individuals who said, look, you know, this is something that I learned when I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the 1960s or 70s, or sometimes the wife of someone who had been deceased would tell a researcher. But the stories, as I see it, have a strong consistency. And so when David Grush, a year and a half ago, is essentially not repeating those, but telling the same type of account, yes, I'm sure it would be shocking to many people, but to myself, what made it unique is that he was saying it under oath in live session to members of Congress. It wasn't necessarily different than what many of us studying this have come to conclude, but it was important. And I'm glad he said what he did. The Pentagon's denials are, you have to expect that. How possibly could the Pentagon say, oh, yes, this is quite real. Yes. We've been totally outclassed by these things for 80 years now. They literally fly circles around our aircraft. They have disabled our aircraft carriers for a half hour at a time. Yes, there are such cases. They've hung out over our nuclear installations. Oh, yeah, back in 1967, they shot off about a dozen of our missiles. There's no way the Pentagon is going to cop to that. They can't. They cannot, especially now. You know, the U.S. empire is hanging on by its fingernails. Not going well. They're not going to want to give this up.
Do you ever get the sense over the years that there's like the old guard who took control of it maybe in the 40s and 50s, but now they're retiring, or maybe I shouldn't say it, but dying off, and the younger people are coming through who are more open to it? Do you see that happening at all, or are they just carrying on?
What I see is a never-ending power struggle. I don't know that the younger people or the younger generation on this are more open or liberal or whatever word we want to use for it. I'm not sure about that. As a matter of fact, I recall speaking to one gentleman, this is about 20 years ago. He, for a while in the 1990s, had access to some very high-level individuals in this, and he doesn't now, but he did. And he said, yeah, I had a conversation with a 4-star general on one occasion who described the international nature of how this information is controlled and talked about a generational divide. But what this general said to this individual, who I used to know pretty well, he said that the older generation was starting to think, yeah, we should probably consider giving this information up. It was the younger generation that said, no, we haven't made enough money on it. The younger ones were the greedy ones. The younger ones were the ones who wanted to keep it going. At least now this is 20-year-old information. Has it changed? It could. What you find within what I have found in the, let's call it the UFO cover-up, there's always factions. You know, there's an all ruling elites throughout all of history. There's always factions, you know, Caesar and Pompey, Disraeli and Gladstone. Who knows? There's always differences of opinion on how the empire should be run within the United States as well. And there's always differences of opinion, as I've seen within the UFO community cover-up, how things should be. There have always been factions, as far as we can tell, that wanted to see more openness on this subject, even back in the 1950s. They just were always on the losing side of any power struggle that took place. But there's always been this. And so what I see today is, you know, 2017, when the organization To the Stars Academy first came out, as it were, TTSA, Tom DeLonge and Hal Puthoff and Christopher Mellon and all of those guys, they come out, and there was a lot of debate over what their actual motives were. Were they part of a government op to give a false disclosure? I heard that a lot. What I've always believed is that they were a faction that just had, for their own reasons, wanted to promote UFO openness against a very entrenched culture that opposed that. Were their intentions all as pure as the driven snow? I have no idea. Did they maybe want to make money themselves on some of the technology that they knew existed? Totally possible. That's my own speculation. I'm just guessing. But for whatever the motivations, they wanted to promote information on this subject in a way that would open up the public conversation and also allow them to talk to members of Congress, which they have done, which has been happening now ever since. So their gambit has succeeded to a large extent. I would say it succeeded more than any other previous attempts have. But whether it's a generational divide, I don't think so. I mean, I know Hal Puthoff personally. He's in his mid late 80s. He's part of that group, you could say. I don't know if he's a disclosure activist. I wouldn't say that. But he definitely does think that there should be more information about this to the public than has existed. I know that because he's told me. So how the factions break down is a really good question, and we need to keep studying that.
And there's also this idea that the people might say, oh, the government knows what's going on and they should disclose it. But I wonder about compartmentalization, and there's different groups who know different things and they don't talk to each other because they don't know the other guys know anything about it. So
that's right.
When it comes to disclosure, what does the government won't really know what to disclose. They need to...
You nailed it. I think that's right. How much does the president, any president of the United States, know about this? How much does the Secretary of Defense or any Secretary of Defense know? Or the head of the CIA? What we know in the United States is that you're not looking at the government. You're looking at a labyrinth. You're looking at competing factions. This happens within presidential administrations. That's why leaks occur and classified documents or sensitive documents constantly leak out. Doesn't matter who's the president. This has always been the case because there's always been differences of opinion, even within a presidential administration, let alone the entire massive bureaucracy of the United States government, which is enormous and is filled with fiefdoms and territorial disputes money. Everyone's fighting over government money. They're out to suck at the teat, and they all are competing for that. So sometimes they cooperate. Sometimes they compete. Sometimes they steal each other's funding. It's a war. It's a war. And to think it would be any different relating to the subject, the highly national security sensitive, financially sensitive, civilizationally sensitive subject of UFOs. I mean, to think that there would be no competition, no divergences of opinion. I mean, that's not very realistic, it seems to me. Of course there will be. Everyone either wants a piece of the action, the money, or their ideologues who believe the public should never know, or they believe the public should know. It's an ideological thing with many people. There's all different, there's the religious faction within the U.S. government. There's many conservative Christians who are convinced. Luis Elizondo wrote about this in his recent book, Imminent. Some people have called them the Collins elite. They seem to be a real group. It's a group of conservative, you could say biblically fundamentalist Christians within the military who believe that these UFOs are demonic. And they have their own perspective on this. So within all of these competing groups, and then we're not even talking about the privatization of this secret. And this may be the single most important thing to bring up here in the secrecy, which is, you know, let's say I'm the U.S. Army. My people have recovered a flying disc that's not from around here, not from our neighborhood. So what am I going to do with this disc? Well, the Army's got some smart people who can study this. But really, truthfully, if you want anything done with this, you're going to have to give this to private industry. They have the scientists. They've got the research and development. They've got the money. They've got the geniuses, far more than I would, who can study this. And also, because the U.S. military is dominated by private contractors, why else would we have F-35s that cost $1 trillion and can't do anything against, you know, little cheap drones? I mean, the whole system is unbelievably corrupt, corrupted by money. So what I would want to do if I'm the Army is when I retire, I will go work for Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, General Electric, whatever, who are working on these technologies. And then I can make a lot of money myself. That's how it is. That is the system. And so the UFO tech part of it is perfect for this type of privatization. So then let's say Lockheed gets my tech that my Army people recovered. Okay, great. So now who owns it? There's a real question for the lawyers. Who owns it? Who has custody of it? I don't know. Maybe the military or the CIA will retain custody officially, legally, even if an organization like Lockheed possesses it. In fact, this has been coming out just recently, and this may come up in the UAP hearing, which, as you and I are speaking, will be in 24 hours, exactly from right now. That's entirely possible because there has been information that's come out that during the 2008 or so period, OSAP, which was the got the name of the program within the Defense Intelligence Agency to study UAP or UFOs, that during that time, there was an attempt for Bigelow Aerospace, which was the main contractor to OSAP, to acquire non-human technology from Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin supposedly was in the process of transferring this when it was blocked by a high-level CIA officer named Glenn Gaffney. His name came out. Is it true? I don't know. It might be. It would be a good question to ask at the hearing because there's some relevant people who could speak to it. Who is in control of this? And so that transfer supposedly was stopped. And it leads many of us to think, was that the actual purpose of OSAP to begin with? No one's really ever talked about this. The point was for Robert Bigelow, who was a good friend of late Senator Harry Reid, who they were all part of this. They wanted to get this technology. Everyone's behind the scenes fighting over this stuff because it's valuable. They want it. That doesn't mean they want to tell the world about it. They just want it. They want it for themselves. That attempt seemed to have failed. But now the story is coming out. I would love to hear someone in Congress ask about this at the hearing. I hope that they do. So we're dealing with a subject. I mean, it's, think about all the areas where UFOs are just fascinating. Existentially, phenomenologically, in terms of, are we alone in the universe? Yes. Then there's the question of, who the hell are these other beings? Where have they come from? Why are they here? Why are they interested in us? Where are they living, by the way? Are they in the oceans? I'm looking at that question currently. Are they on underground bases? Do they live off world? What is their message to us? What are they trying to, why are they here? And then, you know, what's their technology? How could their technology radically transform our society for the better or for the worse? You know, something that could heat your home for the rest of all time might also be turned into a pretty nifty bomb that could blow up the Pacific Ocean for all we know. There's all these implications here. And then there's, you know, the whole way in which it's affected our society and then transformed our culture. Our cultural reaction to this phenomenon has been quite interesting. And I don't really think we've explored that enough culturally as a society. You know, how would the disclosure of this affect our major institutions? How would it affect the world geopolitically? These are just amazing questions that there's just so much to get into. And, you know, you have our established voices out there when they talk about the subject every once in a while. It's like you're listening to someone in preschool talk about it. I mean, the level of sophistication is so low. It's so basic. It's literally impossible for an ordinary person to understand the full complexities and depth and profundity of this subject by whether it's BBC or ABC or any, like, it's impossible to understand on a sophisticated level. It's such a deep subject that opens up doors in every direction.
And one of the doors, I suppose, is to do with consciousness. Because over time, like, first of all, it was people seeing flying saucers. And then after a few decades, abductions started happening. Then they seemed to turn sinister. But there's always this thing of telepathy with the ETs. And I had a guest on my podcast. She said she woke up standing next to her bed and there were four greys at the end of her bed. And she looked round and her body was still in the bed. And it kind of freaked her out. And next thing she knows, she's in her body. She sits up. The greys aren't there. So when she was out of her body, was she in some kind of astral plane, some kind of area? And that's where the ETs are. So really what I'm getting to is, if they disclose all this stuff, would they also have to say, oh, and by the way, the afterlife is real as well?
She's not the only one to say something like that. My wife, Tracy, in particular, she interviews abductees. And one of them had an experience very similar to what you just described here. A man who seemed like he came out of his body at some point during this experience, this encounter with a non-human being, intelligence. Very interesting. And it's hard to know what to make of it. There's been a number of these accounts over many years and generations of people who talk about having left their body. In my research about this, I will say I tend to believe that there is a non-physical element to this. I have trouble with some of the stories that have come to me because I don't know that I have found all of the witnesses credible. I'll be honest about this. I think a number of them really want attention, or there's a certain, how do you put this in a nice way? Some of them don't seem stable to me. They just don't. And I don't say this to try to be mean to them. It's just, it seems to be true. You have to be careful. But then there are other people who do seem entirely stable and believable and credible. So I think there's something going on there. Just what is the connection? And are these beings all benevolent? Are some or most or all malevolent as we would define it? Or maybe is that it, not even the way to look at it? Maybe they're somehow different and they don't really intend to affect us one way or the other. You know, it's hard to know. I personally think that we human beings are very, very interesting right now in our development as a species. We're doing things that, I mean, even 100 years ago, let alone two or three centuries ago, would be considered impossible and magical. The way that we're having a conversation right now with the Atlantic Ocean between us, looking at each other. It's incredible, really. I mean, I have to pinch myself sometimes and say, yes, you're living in this era. We're now moving into the world of strong AI. Who knows what that will end up? Will that have a form of consciousness or not? I don't know. Quantum computing, genetic manipulation, transhumanism, all like that. That fast. I mean, you know, it was only a few thousand years ago that we didn't even have agriculture. And now we've moved into this, you know, we're here. We've just gotten out of our wooden huts and here we are doing this. So we're in a very different existence. And I could easily think that if there's an intelligence that has the ability to observe with advanced consciousness or advanced technology in some way or another, they found us. And they're like, oh, okay, here's a planet that's got a lot of life. Really cool place. Not a desert planet. They've got deserts, but they've got forests. They've got oceans. They've got life is everywhere. Life explodes on this planet. That's really a cool thing about Earth. I'm sure there's a lot of life in the universe, but is it on every planet? No. Is it on many planets compared with others that are just rocks? No, probably a very small proportion have an abundance of life. So that makes us special there. And then not only that, but Earth has produced a life form that is able to reflect and philosophize about the universe and existence. That's cool. That's different. We engage in abstract thought where we can manipulate our environment. We can become the apex predators and control everything. And so that makes us, I think, interesting. I would think so. And now that we're about to leap into their world, which we are, you know, I think that makes them especially curious. Are they encouraging, or do they think, holy shit, these people have just gotten out of the jungle and they now have nuclear weapons and they're kind of dangerous. What do we do about them? Or maybe the aliens are actually kind of predatory. Why wouldn't some of them be, really? Who's to say why they're all going to be nice? They're all going to be higher, you know, spiritually aware and empathic. And I don't know. Why would that be a rule? So there's a lot of possible perspectives that they would take. And I mean, you know, it's like going to a football match, but you don't have the scorecard. You don't know who the players are. So who are these players? What's their agenda? And one thing that I've been trying to do over the last decade or more is, you know, when I started out studying this, I was very much like just the facts. I wanted to just write out my history books. I didn't want to speculate too much, but I guess I can't just do that. So I'm at a point, I've been at this point for a while, where I want to think about these potential beings. And I openly speculate, and I'm happy to change my opinions. I have changed my opinions many times, but I like to look at the facts as I believe we have them, and then to try to extrapolate based on that. And I think that there's a number of groups that are interested in us right now, because of where we are in our development.
I think that maybe we view them too much from a human point of view. I think the definition of the word alien is something that's unknowable, not something that's unknown. And they may think so differently from us that working out what an agenda is could be so difficult. But also, you could say, what's the human race agenda? Well, the Russians is different to the USA, which is different to North Korea. So you may have all sorts of factions, like you say, amongst all these different aliens.
Yeah, think of it this way. We're mammals. So we're born to mothers. We nurse, if we're lucky, at our mother's breast for a certain period of time. And if not, we got a bottle, but we bond with our mother. our father, hopefully, if things all go well. We have a nice little family situation there. And so we are raised with a psychology that is foundationally based on love of our mother and our family. And that drives us our whole lives. We're all looking for love. That's what we want. That's what we're always, that's a human being journey, is to find other people who love us, that we love, that we can connect to. But what if you're not like that? What if you're artificially created? What if you don't really have a mother in that sense? It's entirely conceivable that that could be the case. If you have a society that is so technologically advanced, they don't do that anymore. So how would that change your psychology? How would that change your motivations? Or what if you don't use language, vocal language, but everything is through some kind of telepathy, whether it's brain chips, where there's no mental privacy ever. And so you are part of a hive mind. You're part of a group. You don't exist as an individual separate in consciousness. How would that change your attitude? How would it allow you to communicate with these various human beings? Well, I don't have a full answer to that, but I have to think it would have an extremely different psychology to these beings. They would, things that would be important to them would be very different from things that are important to us. Or let's say you have an entity that's not even physical, if I can even imagine that. Before we started our actual conversation, which I didn't know you were recording it, but you could use it. But I was talking about my dad's passing, 6 years ago. And somehow, and I will go for the rest of my life convinced that my father was trying to communicate with me when he died through the electrical wiring of my house. So there's a non-physical something going on there. How does that work? What's your psychology going to be like if you don't need to eat food or breathe air or sexually reproduce? I mean, it just creates a completely different kind of state of being that I can try to understand that, but I'm not like that, so it's difficult. But it has to translate into a different kind of psychology.
But we've just about run out of time. We were going to talk about your book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind.
Oh, but I think we actually did. Because all of the themes that we have discussed, they're in that book. I wanted that book to be a book for a critically minded student who wanted to engage in all of the interesting questions, or at least some of the interesting questions of this subject. And I really tried to handle it that way. The history, the philosophy, the science, the development of the subject in the modern era, the politics, the cover-up, the technology, and how it's affected our society and how it might affect our future. And I did try to deal with all of those. And I wanted to make it a one-stop, the best attempt at a one-stop for an intelligent person who's like, why should I study this? Why should I read this? And I wanted that book to be the answer.
I've got a million questions that I didn't ask. So
we'll have to come back for them and we'll have to do them again.
Yeah, that would be great. And thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Simon, it was a pleasure. Honestly, I enjoyed it.
And that was an interview with Richard Dolan about his book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, The Definitive Guide to the UFO Mystery. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. There are two tiers. In the $3 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And in the $6 a month tier, you get an extended episode every week. And my website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.
later that day, I was working on the couch. Tracy was sitting next to me. We're both on our little laptops. And we had just installed these really nice recessed ceiling lights that you could have a dimmer setting so they could go dim or brighter. And I was so happy with these lights. I just had them on because I wanted them on. And they were on this nice dim setting. They were professionally installed. They were beautiful. And suddenly Tracy looks up and said, what's going on with those lights? And they were going like bright, dim, just like this. And I got all huffy and I stood up and I said, that shouldn't happen. Brian's a licensed contractor. I picked out that wiring. I'm staring at the lights and they're just doing this. And I jammed the switch up and down a few times, which stopped it. 15 minutes later, my sister called me to tell me our father had died 15 minutes earlier. There's no way I will ever believe that's a coincidence. I don't know the physics of how that happens. And it's not like my father had a GPS, went through over the New York State Thruway, was able to find my house, find the exact wiring and say, okay, Richie, look what I can do. I don't know how it worked, but there was something there. There's a higher mind, I'm convinced, a higher mind that we are able to tap into. Whatever it is, however it works, it's part of us, but it's beyond us. And I really believe it was that communication with me.
It's never happened again, I suppose. The lights have never done that again.
No, they're perfect.
Yeah.
were perfectly installed. No, absolutely. Yeah. I have other stories. When my mother died, nothing happened with me, but it did with one of my sisters. And it just goes on. So I can't prove it. I can't say scientifically, I know there's something going on, but that I do believe there's a part of our consciousness, our existence, that goes beyond these physical bodies that we are in. How long they exist in that form, I don't know. But they do, I believe. Can't say that I know. I wouldn't go that far, but it's what I think.
Yeah. So your book, UFOs for the
21st. Are we recording right now?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I start recording.
Sure.
So it's, yeah. Okay.
You can use whatever I said. I wasn't expecting that would be part of the show, but whatever you decide is fine.
Yeah. I always just start recording at the beginning of the call.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about your book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind.
Sure.
And do you see a big difference amongst what's happening with UFOs between the 20th century and the 21st? Or do you think it's just the same old thing?